The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. This week, we're going beyond the headlines on global climate change to look at some of the consequences that don't always make the news. We're joined by Dan Ferber to talk about his book, Changing Planet, Changing Health, how the climate crisis threatens our health and what we can do about it. But first, let's learn about the similarities between the denial tactics of advocates against climate change and evolution. I'm Desiree Shell, here with Josh Rosenow. Josh is a Programs and Policy Director at the National Center for Science Education, the only group dedicated to defending evolution in public schools across the U.S. and around the world. He works with students, teachers, parents, and other folks trying to keep accurate science education in classrooms. He got involved in that struggle as a PhD student in ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Kansas when creationists took over the state school board. He blogs at Thoughts from Kansas, where he writes about science, education, politics, and other things. Josh, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to talk to you.
I'm very happy to finally have you on the show. Now, after years of taking on evolution denialists, the NCSE has recently decided to add climate change to its work. Why is that?
It's really a confluence of different factors. Probably the main thing was just seeing over the last 7 years or so now, a series of bills filed in state legislatures across the country, from Florida to Michigan, New Mexico through Tennessee, that all are from the same family. They're not all quite written the exact same way, but they're quite similar in their strategy, sort of claiming that academic freedom requires that teachers be able to bring into classrooms material that contradicts the set curriculum for the district, that contradicts the textbook that the students are using, that students can't be punished for holding views at odds with what they're being taught in class, and so forth. And in some cases, those laws specify that they're talking about evolution and other controversial topics. And some in quite a few of those cases, probably a third of those bills, will not just have evolution, they'll broaden it out so that it's evolution and global warming. Human cloning often comes into that for reasons that are sort of obscure. And so that linkage sort of got into our heads, that clearly other people were seeing similarities. And in talking to teachers, we do a lot of workshops with teachers, we do a lot of outreach to teachers. And in workshops on how to teach controversial issues, When we or people that we work with have been doing those, a lot of the times the teachers who come out to that are already motivated. They already know the issues. So when we're talking about evolution, they're sort of nodding along. They're like, yeah, we've heard all of that. But as soon as the topic of climate change comes up, their ears perk up and they really want to know what to do around that, because they report getting a lot of pressure, and it's the same sorts of things that we're used to hearing about. It's the same rhetoric. It's the same style of argument that we're accustomed to around evolution. And in talking to folks who are involved in environmental education and in earth science education, there's not really anybody doing what NCSE does on behalf of climate change education. So it's something that just felt natural for us to step into.
Now, you've outlined three pillars of creationism. Tell us about them.
The three pillars that we talk about are the idea that, and these are things that you can go back to William Jennings Bryan in the Scopes trial, and he was saying, using these same rhetorical pillars, the same way that creationists at the Discovery Institute today will use the same basic rhetorical styles. The details differ a little bit, but the basic gist of what they, of the style of argument they're making, it has been the same for basically as long as organized creationism has existed. And the first of those is the idea that evolution is weak science, that any day now it's going to be replaced by some, you know, that scientists know that it's on its way out. They know that it's weak science. They know that there's something else coming along just around the corner. And, you know, the only reason that it even persists is the massive conspiracy of scientists to keep this secret, scientists being known as a secretive folk. The second pillar is this idea that evolution is incompatible with Christianity or with religious morality in general. The idea that if you teach evolution, that your children will be led to immoral lifestyles of one form or another. One of the first public hearings that I went to as a grad student in Kansas was in a suburban school in the Kansas City, Kansas area. And someone stood up very worried that he wanted his sons to grow up to be doctors. And if they study evolution, they would become, you know, little Kansas Nazis. This was his phrase. And so that's something that's persistent. It was William Jennings Bryan certainly had the religious aspect of it, but also said that the militarism of Germany in World War I was a result of the fact that evolution was taught in German schools. And we see that still today in modern classrooms and in modern controversy, that evolution is supposed to lead to immorality of pretty much any sort you can imagine. The Discovery Institute has a historian on staff whose focus is trying to show that Darwin caused the Holocaust, basically.
Right.
And then the third pillar is the idea that as a matter of fairness, parents ought to be able to decide what their children are taught. Students ought to be able to be given all the information and allowed to make up their own minds on what they choose to believe. William Jennings Bryan in the Scopes trial, one of his big focus of his advocacy then was the idea that taxpayers should have total control of what's taught in public schools. The irony in his case was that, you know, being this very populist figure, despite having run for president quite a few times over the early 20th century and been rejected by voters consistently whenever he tried to do that. And yet his faith in the voter was undiluted, I guess. And so this is something that is probably the most important of the three pillars today in creationist rhetoric, because there have been enough court cases going after that second pillar argument that they don't want to try to link themselves too tightly to a religious argument. And that third pillar just resonates with classical liberal values, the foundations of American democracy, of Western democracy, this idea that of self-determination, that you can make up your own minds, that, you know, the government doesn't come in and indoctrinate your kids in an idea that you're not comfortable with. And that's the basis of a lot of these bills that I was talking about, too, that it's just the idea that, you know, kids should be able to make up their own mind. They shouldn't be punished for holding views that are at odds with what the established curriculum in their school is. And it sounds appealing until you sort of think about how this would work in, say, a math class. If a child decides, this whole calculus thing seems kind of funky to me, I don't think I hold with that. Like, no, that's not, you don't get to do that. You don't get to decide that infinite limits don't work. You learn about them, and that's what education is for. It's premised on the idea that kids coming into a classroom don't yet have the information to make those decisions, that they need to be educated. And certainly we wouldn't apply the same standards in a history class if someone wanted to bring in Holocaust denial or if someone wanted to say that the South won the Civil War.
Now, how do you extend this to climate change? Well, I should say to opponents of the idea that climate change is happening.
Climate change denial is, for the most part, there are aspects of it that are driven by religious ideology. But for the most part, my sense and the sense of sociologists who've been studying this is that it's not a religious movement. A lot of the people in the most strongly denialist group are self-described atheists. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, libertarians who don't hold with the church. So it's not coming from there. It's not a religious ideology, but I think of it as, instead of religious fundamentalism, as economic fundamentalism. And so you have to translate then the pillars from that religious context to that economic and political context. But once you do that, they translate pretty smoothly. So instead, you know, the first pillar is the same, that climate change is based on weak science. You know, whether it's, this one weather station that I looked at is near an air conditioner vent, and so it will have been warmed. Well, there are 100,000, you know, there are thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of weather stations around the world. And even if you take out all of them that could potentially be problematic, the temperature record does not change as a result of that. That's right. Not what it's about. You know, so they'll concoct these elaborate stories of how climate science is on its way out, and any day now someone's going to come up with it's solar cycles, or it's different ocean currents, or it's natural cycles that we don't yet understand, or whatever it is, but it's not humans. Or the Earth isn't even getting warmer. Or it's happening and it's not a problem anyway, so who cares? So you have that, and that's basically the same. And the rhetoric and the tactics, the ways that people make those arguments are often indistinguishable from what we hear around evolution.
Right. And so that first pillar is essentially about creating doubt.
Yeah, it's fear, uncertainty, and doubt. It's the tobacco industry strategy of doubt is our product. That you don't have to show that climate change is bad science or present a viable alternative. You just have to say that there's enough doubt here that maybe, you know, let's just teach both sides and leave it at that. It's an essential element of the arguments that of the other two pillars to open up that wedge of doubt to let the other ones work. Because if the science is really as well resolved as consensus statements from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the National Academy of Sciences in any of various countries that have put out reports on this, then there's really not, the other pillars don't have anything to stand on. The second pillar is about, instead of talking about evolution being incompatible with religion and religious morality, it becomes a matter of a sort of economic morality that you'll often hear. There's a group in New Mexico that has gotten a lot of attention lately because they've got a section on their website urging people to, it's a oil industry sort of front group that was actually founded by the person who did, who produced Ben Stein's movie Expelled about evolution a couple of years back. He started this group, and on their website, they've got a section that says smash the watermelons, which people think, probably rightly so, has a certain racial undertone. But they define watermelons as environmentalists because they're green on the outside and red on the inside.
Wow.
So saying, you know, treating environmentalism as a communist front group.
As red baiting, right.
And you see that a lot. You see that from James Inhofe. You see that from all sorts of leading climate change denialists who will say that we have to oppose certainly climate change policies. We can't do anything about it. And it probably doesn't exist anyway, because if it did exist and if we did anything about it, that would destroy the free market economy as we understand it, and that would be horrible.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with Josh Rosenow, Programs and Policy Director at the National Center for Science Education. We're talking about some of the parallels between evolution denialism and global warming denialism. So, third pillar.
The third pillar is often expressed in much the same language about, you know, we want to make our own choice about what our children are going to learn. On matters of personal choice and personal freedom with climate change, it also impacts people's personal behavior. So I don't want to have to drive a Prius, or I don't like the light that compact fluorescents produce, so don't make me give up my incandescent bulbs. There was a big fight in Congress this year over trying to repeal a law passed a couple of years back that required increased efficiency from incandescent light bulbs. But there was a big fight over this. Mm-hmm. People who wanted their old incandescent bulbs, their old inefficient ones that release 95% of their energy as heat rather than light. I don't pretend to understand that, but that's a big component of it, both mm-hmm. as a matter of personal behavior and certainly as a matter of what comes up in schools. And we've seen this. There was a resolution that the South Dakota legislature passed last year, which borrowed a lot of the language that was used around the same idea from creationist bills of the 1980s. In the 80s, there were bills in Louisiana, passed in Louisiana and Arkansas, considered in other states, that required equal time. If you were going to teach evolution, you had to give equal time to creationism. You had to have a balanced treatment of these different viewpoints. And the South Dakota resolution called for balanced treatment of global warming, echoing things that William Jennings Bryan said in the 20s, you know, global warming is a theory, not a fact. It should be taught just as a theory. Students should learn to think about it from all different sides and make up their own mind. And the same thing happened in a local school district in Colorado, where parents got together a petition asking the school board to either remove global warming from the classrooms or to teach both sides and let kids make up their own mind. So very much the same rhetoric around education specifically, but also just in general about how people approach the issue. They see it through that lens of personal choice.
Now, creationists on the whole seem to be against the concept of global warming, but that doesn't flow both ways, does it?
There have been a few surveys where people were actually asked, the same people were asked about evolution and about climate change, for one of them so far, I've been able to find to get the actual crosstabs to be able to look and see in the general public in the U.S. how that compares. And so there's certainly a strong correlation between people who say that humans and other living things have existed in their present form since the beginning of time are much more likely to say that the Earth is not getting warmer, or that the Earth is getting warmer mostly because of natural changes in the atmosphere, than people who say that humans and other living things have evolved over time. So there's correlation, but there are also plenty of that doesn't overlap.
So the anti-climate change people aren't necessarily anti-evolution. So do you think that's a tactic? Is that what they're presenting to the public for just sort of PR purposes? Or do the anti-climate change people actually generally trust science except for that one area then?
With all denialisms, you almost always see an underlying reliance on science, mm-hmm. right? Anti-vaccine advocates are going to point to their studies, to their at least purported research. Mm-hmm. There's still a respect for science on some level and a desire to co-opt it for their own purposes.
Right.
And you see that in both of these cases. And the reason that I think of both of these as being driven by a fundamentalism is that it's a willingness to reject the empirical evidence if it contradicts one's personal ideology.
Oh, cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
Professional global warming deniers, they don't seem exactly fond of creationism or of its proponents sometimes. But in pushing forward using similar tactics to what creationists use by creating doubt about sound science and by using intellectually dishonest tactics, let's say, they're basically creating a space that allows for wider acceptance of creationism and pseudoscience in general.
I think that's true. I think it's something when you look especially at how creationists write about climate change denial, they will often pick up on the parallel claims that the different groups make. Mm-hmm. You know, they both claim that the peer review system is broken because it's set up to exclude any sort of minority opinion, and that's why their papers can never get published, why their data can't get as widely promulgated as contrary evidence, as evidence supportive of the scientific consensus. They jumped all over the stolen emails a couple years back that initially people were claiming showed that there was all of this fraud and all of these horrible behaviors by climate scientists. And, you know, they've been remarkably silent about all of the subsequent investigations that have been done by the British Parliament, I think the Dutch Parliament, by the National Science Foundation's Inspector General. There have been 7 or 8 separate investigations in different countries, all of them finding no wrongdoing, no evidence in these emails of any sort of abuse of scientific norms and standards. But at the time, they were all over that because it seemed to validate their claim that the scientific community wasn't interested in hearing contrary evidence, which is a fairly profound misunderstanding of how science works, to claim that science somehow excludes minority views. That's getting minority views out there is sort of how you succeed in science, right?
If this is in fact the case, then how do we apply that? How do we apply that knowledge?
Organized creationism probably started, depending, you can draw the beginnings of it in various places, but it's on the order of a century old now. And for the last 30 years, public opinion on evolution is essentially unchanged. If the same thing happens around climate change, if public opinion hardens and it becomes this purely partisan exercise where what happened with evolution is that sometime around the 20s or 30s, if you were a fundamentalist, if you were a particular sort of Christian, it just became part of your identity that you rejected evolution. You didn't need to look at the science because in order to be the sort of person that you believed yourself to be, you knew that you had to reject it. If we wind up in the same place with climate change that we have with evolution over the last century, the results actually will be, on a global scale, catastrophic. There are bad things that happen if people don't accept that evolution is real. They don't pay attention to antibiotic resistance. They are less able to participate in 21st century medicine and in 21st century economies. But they can be consumers on some level and survive. Climate change is going to change the world in ways that are going to be, some of them, fairly catastrophic. And if this sort of identity politics comes to dominate our response to it, that could really be catastrophic and really worrisome. So I spent a lot of time thinking about what seeing those links can tell us. And I would say that there are paths that run both ways. creationism has existed in this sort of organized political movement form since at least the 1920s and probably the teens. And so there's a lot we can learn from our mistakes. We can learn from, you know, what was it that happened in those early years? Was there something that we could have done to break that linkage and to keep it from becoming this social marker rather than just something that you look at the evidence and you do what you're going to do? And so I think that on the climate change front, there's quite a bit that can be learned from what's happened around evolution. There's a lot more research going on right now into the cognitive psychology and the social psychology of climate change denial than I think there really has been over the years into creationism because of the urgency of the problem. So I think that there's a lot that we're going to be able to learn from that body of research, perhaps to see ways to better connect with people around evolution.
I like how you left that optimistic. Thank you.
It's the only way that you can really, you know, work at this long term and stay sane, to have a little bit of optimism along the way.
Josh, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for being here.
Sure thing.
We've linked to Josh Rosenow and the National Center for Science Education on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And stay tuned, because after the break, we'll be back to talk to Dan Ferber about his book, Changing Planet, Changing Health: How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
My guest is Dan Ferber, contributing correspondent for Science Magazine. He specializes in putting a human face on groundbreaking stories about science, technology, health, and the environment. He's one of the authors of Changing Planet, Changing Health: How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks, Desiree. It's great to be here.
So when we talk about climate change, most people usually think of melting glaciers and extreme weather, and that's about it. But there are other ways that climate change is actually affecting us, and specifically our health. So why don't we think about that? Is this a new field?
It's actually not a new field. It's been around for about 20 years now. And my co-author, Dr. Paul Epstein, who's with the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School, he was one of the leaders in this field from the beginning to raise awareness first among the medical community and then and scientists and then among the broader public that this is we're not just talking about polar bears. This is about human health and the rapidly changing climate affects human health in a variety of ways.
And the study of climate's effect on health is extremely interdisciplinary.
If we're talking about complex systems, you know, the climate system is inherently complex itself, and then you're dealing with changes to entire ecosystems. And just the effects, they vary from, you know, infectious diseases and heat waves and changes in the marine environment. You need expertise from a whole variety of fields to really get a handle on this. And you also need, and I think Paul has excels at this, you need a big picture perspective and pull on expertise from a lot of different fields.
Well, let's talk about some of the specific illnesses that are affected by climate. As you said, Dr. Paul Epstein, the co-author of the book, he himself started out looking at cholera.
Cholera, that was an epiphany for him. It came from a cholera epidemic in South America in the early 90s. And his epiphany came from some work by Dr. Rita Caldwell, who was a former director of the National Science Foundation, the work she had done on cholera. The connection is that, first of all, her work over several decades found out that a reservoir for cholera, meaning the question at that time was, what happens to cholera in between epidemics? It's caused by a bacterium. What happens to that bacterium in between epidemics, which could be years? Where does it hide out? It had to hide out somewhere and come back to the next epidemic. And it turned out it hid out in the sea. And Dr. Caldwell found that these bacteria happened to hitch a ride on tiny marine animals called zooplankton. So what happens is, as the ocean warms, there's more likely to be blooms of algae, which are food for these tiny animals, so you get blooms of them too, and then storms take these creatures inland, and they carry the bacteria with them, and she did a lot of work in Bangladesh. The bacteria would get to inland waterways, and an epidemic would get started. Of course, it's affected by, sanitation as well. It's that sort of disease. But this is where it started. So the connection for Paul back in the early 90s was, here was an epidemic that started off the coast of Peru. It happened when there was an El Nino, which means that area of ocean got warmer, and it started at three separate places at just about the same time. They were 1,800 miles apart, so it really seemed to be coming from the sea, and that was a little spark for him that this is, in fact, climate can actually affect human health, and that's when he dove in, and we're talking about 1993 now. So from there, he looked at a lot of different diseases.
The next one was malaria.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Taking a step back, I mean, infectious disease in general can be affected by a warming climate in two ways. One way is, and I'm talking specifically about infectious diseases that are carried by insects and other cold-blooded animals, and the reason why is that as temperature changes just a little, it really affects the biology of these types of organisms. So we're talking about mosquitoes, we're talking about flies, we're talking about ticks. So in the case of malaria, it's a mosquito-borne disease. It's obviously a huge public health problem worldwide. And in sub-Saharan Africa, just many, many millions of people affected. What's happening there, it's a lowland malaria where it's always been. Okay, there, and so it really hasn't changed too much there. But there are other areas that are at high elevations that used to be malaria-free because it was too cool there for the mosquitoes to live, and also too cool for the parasites to complete a life cycle inside the mosquito in the 3 weeks that a mosquito lives. So by raising the temperature just 1 or 2 degrees, that changes radically. And that's very well documented by studies on malaria biology over the decades. It's been well studied. And so what's happening there is these malaria-carrying mosquitoes are moving higher up into the mountains in western Kenya and central Kenya, we talked about in Changing Climate, Changing Health. And they're exposing people there, and the people who live there have not been exposed to malaria before.
Right.
So they're sort of like the Native Americans when smallpox came in. They just don't have the immunity. And what I should say is that in the lowland areas, many, many people get exposed as young children, and some succumb to the disease, most survive, and then if you get it a second time, it's like a bad case of the flu, so they have some resistance. But in the highland areas, they don't have that resistance, and malaria can potentially cause epidemics, and that's bad news.
And so it's the same situation with dengue fever and Rift Valley fever then?
So there's another way that climate can affect infectious disease. So we're talking about where the disease can happen, the range of the disease, and that's really important. Also with Lyme disease, it's important. The range is expanding into eastern Canada from the United States, and models predict it will expand. But the other way that climate can infect infectious disease is by increasing the probability of an epidemic, and that happens, and it's not expected. It was a surprise to me, but through the extreme weather. So as the world warms, the ocean, the atmosphere warms, but the oceans do too, and the water cycle speeds up, which means that more water comes off the ocean. It's more humid, more extreme rains, and those situations can lead to standing water where mosquitoes breed, and actually. That's the case with Rift Valley fever, is that these outbreaks happen, and with malaria too, these outbreaks happen when it's particularly rainy in Africa. So there are two ways that climate affects infectious diseases, the range and it's the weather can trigger an outbreak.
We have a question from Lindy.
It's basically impossible to say for sure that any one day's weather is caused by climate change. Is it the same thing for disease outbreaks? Can you say for sure that one infection or another is climate change related?
I think the answer is the same in both of those, for both of those examples. I mean, you have to look at patterns over a long period of time. So you can't just take a particular disease outbreak or a particular hurricane or thunderstorm, you know, the flooding incidents, and say it's caused by climate change. Climate is an average weather over time. So to show that there is a link between climate and disease, this is some work that my co-author Paul Epstein did in the late 90s. He used El Nino as a laboratory. So
right.
let me explain what I mean by that. El Nino changes the climate on five continents for 2 or 3 years at a time. It's like a temporary climate change. And he mapped out worldwide where were the epidemics, and they were in the areas where El Nino exerted an effect on the weather. So demonstrating that a changing climate, a temporarily changing climate, can affect the incidence of outbreaks of diseases. So you have to look at it at that scale rather than the scale of a particular outbreak. The same sorts of changes that happen during an El Nino, the ocean gets warmer off of Peru, like we talked about before, off South America, and other changes, it's thought to be a good way to consider the possible effects of climate change down the line.
Now, what about the effect on asthma and allergies?
That's another example of somewhat surprising effects. One way that the warming climate can affect, take allergies for starters. First of all, ragweed pollen is the number one cause of fall allergies. So this time of year, September, early October, if you're sneezing and you're in the United States or Canada, likely it's due to ragweed pollen. And what Paul and a scientist named Lou Ziska at USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, found about 10 years ago is that if you create the atmosphere that we expect by mid-century with twice the carbon dioxide, that makes ragweed produce twice as much pollen. And not only that, but the pollen itself, the protein that causes the allergic reaction, there's twice as much of it. So that was a big surprise, and we can see the effects. And actually, Dr. Ziska did a follow-up study in the real world, which is using as a laboratory the urban heat island effect. So around Baltimore is where he studied, but around cities, the carbon dioxide level was higher inside of cities because of all of the industry and exhaust. And he compared that to out in the countryside, and sure enough, the ragweed grew bigger, it produced more pollen, and so the plants were responding to the environment already today, comparing the city to the countryside. So that's kind of a predictor for what's going to happen down the line. And that's just allergies. Then you take air pollution, which aggravates asthma. So asthma is aggravated by allergies and also by pollution. And as it gets warmer, the reactions that cause ozone to form in cities, ozone forms from the chemicals in car exhaust, and it forms faster when it's warmer. So warmer temperatures lead to more ozone, which is the main ingredient of smog. And also, if you have a lot of soot particles, the black stuff that comes out of the truck exhausts and burning diesel, both of these are known to irritate respiratory tissue. So there, right there, you have these aggravate asthma. And, you know, I met a family in Harlem, a mom and three kids, and reporting the book, and they were all affected by asthma, and they lived in a very polluted area of Harlem. So We're talking about, again, there are multiple causes for asthma attacks. We're talking about one, and the effects are indirect, but they're very real, and they affect people, and they're affecting people already.
Well, since we're talking about plants, one of the most interesting case studies in the book I thought it was the most interesting, was soybeans and how they respond to higher CO2 levels.
That was another, for me, totally unexpected until I dove into this book and learned from Paul and from some of the other scientists. So I actually visited a lab at the University of Illinois where they're studying the same sort of experiment we were just talking about, where you create the atmosphere that we expect in 2050. So I guess as background, I should probably fill it in. The carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere has been steadily climbing for about a century, but it's been climbing at a faster rate in the past few decades. And we now have 40% more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than we did before the Industrial Revolution. And that's projected to keep going up because we keep burning all the coal, oil, and gas that's producing it and cutting down forests. So assuming that, you know, it could be about twice the level of pre-industrial levels of carbon dioxide, what they found was, let me take a step back. The original idea is that carbon dioxide is plant food. You know, we breathe out carbon dioxide, plants breathe it in, they use it to form their tissues, and that's been known forever. So the original idea is that higher carbon dioxide levels, it would green the earth and plants would grow better, and including crop plants, and everything would be hunky-dory because yields would go up. And, you know, and there was some early evidence from greenhouse studies that sort of supported this, and some oil companies made some ads and had a field day in the early 90s with this. But it turns out to be not exactly true, because what they found in Illinois is that in this field setup, and what it is, it's an open field with a little hose around the perimeter and the monitor inside, and you're walking around in this field and you're hearing psh, 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 pumping out the carbon dioxide, and the monitor is keeping that carbon dioxide at a steady level higher than the air around it. It's exposed to the pests that any farm field would see. It's exposed to extreme weather, thunderstorms, hail, whatever, that can harm crops. And what they found is that the crops had more insect damage in these higher carbon dioxide conditions. That was a total surprise. They've spent the last 7 or 8 years working out the details of this, of why this is happening. But that's, and it has to do with the communication between plants and insects and sort of chemical warfare that always happens between plants and insects. So that's going to affect yields. And there are other ways that climate change can knock down agriculture. And so this is a book about health. And so what does this have to do with health? You know, we're talking about the ability to produce enough food for, you know, 7, 8, 9 billion people. And there are already food shortages in parts of the world. We have a famine in Somalia and others. So food production is a big deal, and food security is a big deal. So we need to be aware of this issue.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Dan Ferber, one of the authors of Changing Planet, Changing Health: How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Now, weather fluctuations, not just warming, they're a problem as well, I assume.
Right. The extreme weather. Absolutely, it can be. And we've seen that on the news a lot this year. I mean, we've seen, you know, I want to be careful here, and it's again back to the question that your listener mentioned, which is that you can't pin any particular storm on climate change.
Right.
So I just want to say that the incidence of extreme weather is already rising. Their downpours of more than 6 inches a day have become 27% more common in the United States since 1970. Those are averages over time. This is well documented. So when we say that climate change is affecting extreme weather, it is well documented, but we're talking on average. So with that said, these downpours of heavy rains, of course, can cause flooding, and we've seen devastating floods in the United States. We saw it in Cedar Rapids in 2008, in Nashville in 2010, and Pakistan got hit very hard last year. So we've seen a lot of floods from that, and severe floods they can harm people in a lot of ways. In the developing world, where you don't have the infrastructure and sanitation, they can breed a lot of epidemics of different sorts of diseases, including dengue fever. You have standing water and you get mosquito-borne diseases and diarrheal diseases because you have breakdown of sanitation when there's so much water around. And even in the developed world, in the U.S. and Canada, you have the floodwaters recede, you have mold covering houses, mold is a respiratory health threat. So you have a lot of ways that this can play out, and then you have blizzards in the Northeast in particular has seen a lot of that in the past few years, and Northeast U.S. and so they can affect people from heart attacks from shoveling snow is a documented effect that they tend to go up during these heavy snows, and things like car crashes, so ice storms, it's so unexpected ways that if you have more fluctuation in the weather, more of this extreme, then it's going to affect people. And of course, there are heat waves, which is a big human health threat, and it's one of the biggest. And they kill 1,500 people a year in the United States. And this is directly from things like heat stroke, but also indirectly from heart attacks. And again, in the cities, it can make the pollution worse. So you get a combination of different factors that can debilitate or threaten health, and that's some of the ways that extreme weather can play out.
But that's the thing. We do think about extreme weather as potentially dangerous, but it's these other things that you've written about in the book, the idea that, let's say, the situation with mountain pine beetles and how that's affected.
That's another little bit circuitous route back to the health effects, but let's trace it because it's worth understanding. Before diving in, I just want to say that one of the things that Paul Epstein and I have tried to emphasize in this book is that climate change affects us in ways that are indirect and not necessarily obvious. And in the case of the mountain pine beetles, by changing the ecosystems, the forests, the coastal oceans that we depend on for clean air, clean water, healthy food, we depend on these systems. By changing them rapidly, we can cause unpredictable changes that can boomerang on us. And so in the case of mountain pine beetles, I did some reporting in Yellowstone National Park, and at the high elevations there, they're above 7,000 feet, you have a tree called whitebark pine, different pine species at lower elevations. So forever there have been these mountain pine beetles that live out in the West, and they basically fought the trees to a draw, and they code like a lot of parasitic types of species. The trees have defenses, and the beetles get around those defenses, and that's been the balance for a long time. But climate change is tipping the balance. And at the high elevations where the whitebark pine are, they never really had defenses, that chemical defenses against the beetles, because it would get so cold that the insects would just die. Every few years, it got to 40 below zero for several days at a time, and that was it for the insects, and they died back. But it's not getting that cold anymore at all. And so you have entire stands, big stands of centuries-old whitebark pines. And I saw this, and it's a tragedy. You see these trees that have been around for sometimes 1,000 years, and they're dying in a year or two. And whole stands of them are dying from these infestations. So we're causing a real wholesale change in these high altitudes. And how does that, again, affect us? Because that's sort of what we're all about in this book. We're focusing on the human effects. Well, I mean, for one thing, it's the combined effect of the beetle infestations, the warming temperatures, because the mountains are getting affected the most, and the northern latitudes are getting seeing the biggest rises in temperature. So it's getting warmer. It's getting drier in the mountains. And you're getting these infestations that turn these stands of forest into standing tinder. Well, you put those all together, you get a longer fire season, you get more severe fires, and there has been some good science tracing back longer fire season to climate change, the old idea of we didn't thin the forest enough, and that's why we're seeing more fires. That was logical, but it turns out that climate change is actually lengthening the fire season. I mean, there's just it's easier to burn when there's no snow cover. So we still haven't gotten to people. So what happens then? So you have all these, you have more forests, more fires. They're worse fires all through the West. And the smoke from those fires is the biggest air pollution problem in the West. And air pollution from smoke, it can make a respiratory disease a lot worse, asthma, and it can also raise a risk of heart attacks, as firefighters has been known for a long time. They have the high risk of heart attacks and from the smoke inhalation. So it does come back and affect people indirectly in that way.
This whole book is like a lesson in interconnectedness.
Thank you. Yeah, that was what we were going for.
And really, I just want to point out that in many of the cases that you talked about in the book, our ability to build early warning systems so that accurate predictions can be made and people can take the appropriate action, that's extremely important at this point.
Absolutely. And so Paul Epstein is a public health a scientist and a medical doctor, and this is the public health approach. In public health, you can treat a disease, is what physicians do, but I mean, what public health people do is take a step back and what if we can predict an epidemic before it happens? You mentioned earlier, we talked about Rift Valley fever. That turns out to be one of the best examples of early warning systems. So by looking at how wet it is in East Africa and Southeast Africa, and you can figure out how wet it is by looking at satellite images and seeing how green it is. This is a semi-arid landscape where it gets wetter, it gets greener. It turns out with that and some knowledge of the biology of the disease and the mosquitoes, you can predict epidemics several months in advance. And this is some work that Ken Linthicum of the U.S. Department of Agriculture has developed over 30 years. It's a whole body of work, and now it is good enough that these models can predict epidemics, and they have. Dr. Andrew Gutheko, a malaria expert I talked to from Kenya, he's developing a similar system for malaria. If you can predict an epidemic early, you can mobilize a medicine to an area, you can mobilize medics to an area, and you can save lives. And the similar idea has already been put in place in the U.S. and over the last 15, 20 years with heat waves. So in that case, it's predicting heat waves several days in advance. And with healthy people, you know, you basically say, okay, we'll stay out of the midday sun, don't go, use common sense and stay hydrated. With older people and shut-ins who get hurt, that you know, who are really endangered, you can put them in a van, take them into an air-conditioned cooling center. You can save lives that way, and that works. And so these are ways of being aware of predicting and dealing with things before they happen. So that's one. That's an early warning system. I think it's an important approach.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about climate change and health with science writer Dan Farber. We'll be right back with more of that after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at authors whose fiction appeals to the science lover. We'll speak to astronomer Stuart Clark about his novel The Sky's Dark Labyrinth, the first of a trilogy examining pivotal moments in astronomy history. And we're joined by biologist Jennifer Roan, author of the novel The Honest Look, a thriller about integrity, passion, and betrayal in pharmaceutical research. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. And I'm here with Dan Farber, contributing correspondent for Science Magazine and the co-author of Changing Planet, Changing Health: How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Now, Dan, don't these climate shifts sometimes create some benefits as well?
It's a complex effects. I mean, they can get too hot for mosquitoes and malaria, for example, and that may have happened in parts of Central America. But another point that it could be somewhat beneficial is cold-related injury and death can go down, so that's a good thing, right? So it's not all bad, but on balance, it looks like it will harm us much more than it will help us.
Well, what's the reception been like to this work
in the scientific community? It went through a period of controversy, and it depends on which effects you're talking about. The infectious disease issue was and still is. There still is some controversy about that. I personally think that the argument is very solid. There's a big issue in the United States over a big court case over whether the EPA has the right to regulate greenhouse gases because they're
right.
A health effect. They can only regulate them if they're a health threat. That's the only way they can regulate them under the Clean Air Act. It was a Supreme Court decision. They ordered the EPA to issue regulations. It's certain members of Congress have been really trying to hamper the EPA's ability to issue those regulations. And, you know, from a public point, there's a lot of debate out there in the political realm. In the scientific realm, I think a lot of these effects have been accepted. Others need a lot of further. Many of them need a lot of further study. But there's enough evidence overall that the risk is increasing.
So has the overall reaction changed, maybe since Paul was first researching cholera?
Yeah, I mean, the word is getting out, even just in the 4 years since I first started thinking about doing this book and we started talking about it. Nobody was talking about the human health effects in 2007 that I wasn't hearing it on the news. And we said, oh, well, we have something really novel. We've seen a lot more coverage in the last few years. As these individual studies come out, well, you know, dengue fever, there was a dengue outbreak in Key West in 2009, and so it's moved back into the United States, and stories like that, and the heat wave of last summer in the U.S., and, you know, that you see a lot of extreme weather. So you get people, you know, when you have a lot of extreme weather and outbreaks, you tend to get people talking about it, and that's what's happened in the past couple of years. And I just think awareness is just generally growing.
If it is being spoken about more favorably than it was, is that partially because the models are successful that are being built for disease spread and infectious diseases?
Yeah, I don't really think the word has gotten out there much in terms of these models. This is still very much an active area of research. People and they can very much be improved and they can be developed for other diseases. I think public awareness is been driven by what's been happening in the real world and the news coverage, and just some better coverage by the media compared to, say, 5 or 10 years ago. There's no more false balance. There's no more idea of we have to quote a climate denier on climate change.
So right within the title of your book is the "and what we can do about it" part. So let's talk about that bit. The solutions that you wrote about were mainly technology-focused.
Technology, yes, and also policy. The big picture goal that we're aiming for with all of these technology and policies is to, like everybody else, you know, move the world towards renewable energy, towards powering our societies on with renewable energy that doesn't produce carbon dioxide, climate warming, carbon dioxide and other climate warming gases. So, we can talk about things that individuals can do. We didn't talk about that much, but there were some stories that we told in the book. I mean, just friends of mine, in fact, that I wrote about that put in a geothermal heating system in their ground source heat pump at their house, and it saved them half off on their heating bills, and it paid itself off in about 5 or 7 years. These are things that people can do with a little bit of investment. We're talking a little more about something that takes a little more than riding the bus or, you know, riding your bike to work. We're talking about the next level up. So there's a lot of things that individuals can do. We can weatherize houses and things like that, buy a more efficient car, things that people have heard of. Another policy thing, really what's most exciting to me is what communities are doing, the more progressive communities that are thinking about this and planning for the future. So you weatherize a house and you're saving half the emissions, or you know, some 25% of the emissions from your heating and cooling bills. Okay, that's good. But how do you get a whole city to do that with thousands and thousands of buildings? Well, Cambridge, Massachusetts did that by a creative financing through a public-private effort. They came up with a big pot of money. They said, we're going to weatherize your house, whether you're a homeowner or a business, and you don't have to pay a thing up front, and we're going to pay for it. And, well, how does that make sense? Well, they get paid back from the energy savings for 5 or 7 years. So this isn't really new technology. There's nothing new about what they're doing technologically, but from a policy point of view, it actually is very new. There are things like, people are developing green roofs and people are and there's all, technology is very important too, you know, developing better ways of buildings, you know, LEED certified buildings, and all of these things are very, very important. But really, I think one of the points that we wanted to make is that the technology, we have the technologies we need
right.
to make a huge, huge dent if we start using them and get serious about making it happen.
We have a bunch of questions piling up here. This is from the chat room from Grave Spinner.
How much do you think the phrase global warming has set back the acceptance of climate change?
I've thought about that quite a bit, actually. I think it has to some degree, because global warming, it sounds so benign. Well, we're just going to hang out. It's going to get a little warmer, no big deal. I think it's unfortunate that term I don't know why it became popular in the 90s, but it did, and it has set things back a little bit, because people didn't realize the severity of what a changing climate could bring.
And a question from the chat from Murray Clare.
How might the health implications of climate change be used as an entryway to educating students and parents about climate change?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, I think that like any other environmental threat to human health, whether it's water pollution or chemical pollution, it's important to let everybody know about it, whatever level they're able to assimilate it. Be different for younger kids, of course, and but also we can focus on solutions and give people specific things that they can do to make a difference. And that, I think, by one of the things that we've tried to do is focus on, we need to move towards a, we call it a low-carbon economy, which just means moving towards being fueled by renewable energy. And there are many, many, many things that individuals can do, just from riding your bike to the store instead of driving the car, and you know, taking the train instead of, you know, loading up the car, that sort of thing. And so there's really something for everybody to the way for everybody to contribute at whatever level. If you're a family, you can plant a tree, you know, you plant some trees at the school. There's all sorts of ways to contribute. So I think it's an important way to think about, not the only way to think about climate change, but it's an important way. And I think everybody can contribute when we think about it that way.
And a question from the chat from Mary M.
Is there a risk tying climate change to disease, as we've seen for tornadoes, etc.? We don't want to give deniers footing, you know.
I think I understand where the questioner is coming from. We don't want to overstep the evidence, is the way I would put it, and I don't think that we are at all. I think we're talking about complex systems. We're also talking about well-documented links. In Changing Planet, Changing Health, we talk about a series of good scientific studies on the link between malaria and climate change, and that's just one example. We talk about we'll get more into the technical details in the book and just really get into the science, but the links are solid if we stick to what we know, if we're honest about what we don't know, and I think we just have to be honest that there's a lot that's not understood well, then I think it's fine. And I think it's important because this is happening.
And that's the thing. Even if, you know, just to play devil's advocate, even if certain things like infectious diseases can't be tied to climate change specifically, the fact that they are tied to weather patterns is vitally important in predicting that so that you can control it.
Right. And, I think the science is really quite solid, linking the warming climate to increase range. I mean, this is not a secret. I mean, tropical diseases stay in the tropics because of temperature and because of weather patterns and climate, and they're not further north because of the climate. And so it's not a secret to infectious disease experts that many diseases are climate linked, and this is old news. But it's very intuitive that if the climate is changing quickly, you can affect the rain where these diseases are, and that is what's happening.
Dan, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And you can find links to Dan Ferber and Dr. Paul R. Epstein's book, Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You'll also find links to our Facebook page and our Twitter feed and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. I have two quick announcements before we sign off. First, you are almost out of time to register for the 60-second science video competition. That's the one where you could win money for creating a science video. Registration closes on the 14th of October, but then you have until October 28th to upload your masterpiece. Check out 60secondscience.net for more information, or click the link on our site on this week's episode. And we'd also like to welcome a newly formed skeptical group to the world. The Okanagan branch of the Center for Inquiry Canada has started a skeptics discussion group in Nelson, BC. I know we have listeners out that way, so if you are in the area, you're invited to come share your love of science and reason with like-minded critical thinkers. You'll find links to CFI Okanagan and the Nelson Area Skeptics on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com.
The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.